I have another role. I'm on the board of an organization called the SAVA Foundation. And I've been chairman of the board for time. And it's about a $3 million a year operation. And we work in four countries with cataract surgery for the blind and health stuff for Guatemalans. We work in Nepal and India with the Native American Indians and so on. And so for those of you that think I'm a complete flake, I do know about spreadsheets and shortfall, and I do a good part of the fundraising, which faces me as a human being with a very interesting question. How do you, when you are representing a Guatemalan widow who's had her children and her husband murdered by the army, and you're there to help her, and you're representing her back in the United States, and you meet a very rich, rich person, how do you meet that person behind the veils of richness and need to meet another being? Can you hear the question? Those of you in fundraising can hear it. Because the hell realm is that the very work you do to do good cuts you off from the living truth between human beings. And so raising money becomes work on yourself. To not get lost, to be able to say to somebody, you have money, these people need it, I'd like to be the vehicle through which you transfer it, without starting to see them as an object to be manipulated to get the money. To not see the dying person as somebody that you want to manipulate for them to die your death. How do you know what kind of death they're supposed to die? Maybe they're supposed to die screaming at the top of their lungs. How presumptuous of us to think we should die their death. We don't know. All I know how to do is keep quieting myself and opening myself and create an environment for another human being where they can come out and play if they want to, spiritually. And if they don't, that's up to them. The predicament with hospice is that it does wonderful work on the physical plane, and it does very, very fine work on the psychological plane. But the spiritual plane gets short shrift. I mean, the whole idea that you spiritually, that you have to justify what you do into a bureaucratic system is like rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's, which you're saying is the spirit is now Caesar's. I feel it's you people who have to demand. Nobody's going to give it to you. You have to demand to be respected for what you do within this organization, if this organization is going to be a healthy organization. Because I think dying is basically an issue in which one deals with the metaphysics of life, and one deals with the mystery, and one deals with the spiritual transformation, and that is the key business. I just worked with a woman who just died of AIDS. She was 42. And she came to me a few months before she was going to die, and she said, I'd really like to work on awakening through this dying process. So we started to just talk together and hang out together, and then she got sicker and sicker, and she went through all the different stages in the hospital, and I spent a lot of time just being with her. And we kept meeting. We meditated together, and we kept meeting behind the game of dying. And she was a very clear person, and she said to the doctor, I'd like the three of us to discuss how much morphine I should get. I want to have control of it, and I want Ram Dass to help me decide that, and I want to do this so I can stay as alert as I can. And the doctor said, fine, that's okay with me. In a hospital, the doctor is the queen or the king. In a football game, the doctor isn't the king or queen, the coach is. The doctor plays a different role. In hospice, who plays what role? Who plays what role? Is it truly collaborative? I just would ask you to examine whether in your heart you think death is too bad, whether you think it's an error, whether you think God blew it. When it's a child or a young person or a this or a that, or it dies this way or that way, do you somehow feel something is wrong? Have you ever considered the possibility you just don't understand? That it's all really working fine? That there weren't any errors in the game? That it's all right to die even young? I mean, I often look at this because I'm very deep into the fact that we go on after death. I look at this as sort of the fourth grade. And the people that took birth here are people who need to deal with lust, greed, agitation, hatred, ill will, sloth, torpor, and doubt. That's who, send them to the fourth grade. See, so you're in the fourth grade and you finish your work and you get out early and everybody's on the fourth grade saying, oh, too bad. I mean, which metaphor do you want? Which metaphor of life do you want? Is longer better? I was with my father. I took care of him for 10 years till he died at 90. The last few years, I mean, I'd stretch it to find the quality of life other than we were just in bliss together all the time, which we would have been whether he was alive or dead, I think. He did incredible work. He went from being a really hard achiever and preoccupied with upward mobility, as he should be in his world and his family. And then as he got older, he started to let go. And then as he got very old, he let go more and more and more. Till finally, he was just a silent, smiling Buddha. And I used to massage him and hold him and talk to him. We'd look at the sunset together and hold hands. He used to be president of a railroad. We never had time for things like that. We'd smoke cigars together and drink brandy. And I remember my brother came in to see him. My brother had always had trouble with my father. And he said, hi, Dad. And Dad just smiled his Buddha smile at him. My brother walked out and said, stinker, he still won't talk to me. And then my aunt came, who loved my father immensely, his little sister. George, how are you? And he just smiled at her and she said, oh, George, what have they done to you? You're gone, you're gone. He was nicer than he'd ever been. He and I were in bliss. They were bugged because he wasn't who he used to be. It's interesting how well you are allowing people to change. How much you hold on to who they used to be. It's like meeting a person for the first time each time you meet them and allowing them by not having models, not expectations, not things in your head so you see them in certain roles which they then starve in. People get caught in the roles themselves. It's this beautiful Quaker lady dying, and I came to visit her, and she said, "Oh, Ramdas, I want you to help me die. I've had enough." I said, "Gene, what's your rush? I mean, you know, you haven't lost your hearing yet. You haven't lost your sight. There's great lessons learning. It's a precious breath." She said, "Ramdas, I'm so bored." I said, "Well, you're probably bored because you're busy dying all day. I mean, couldn't you die like 10 minutes an hour? You have to die every minute. You know, dying is such a big drama. I'm dying. Then everybody, she's dying. And then it's all, you're dying. Are you dying today? How are you dying? Are you dying well? Are you dying? Here's a counselor for dying. And everything is around dying. And it was just a thing you happen to be doing. I mean, we're all dying. You're not busy going around dying, but everybody in this room will be dead probably within about 70 years. I gave everybody the benefit of the doubt. I had to compute technology and all of the anxiety about death and all that. I said, "Gene, what do you say? Let's just..." She said, "I feel so closed in." She said, the shades are too much, the light's too much, the sound's too much. I said, "Well, Gene, that's because you're trying to pour so much into such a small container. What do you say we expand together?" So we held hands and closed our eyes, and I said, "You hear the kids playing out in the street? Let them be inside of you instead of outside. Hear the clock on the mantelpiece? Let it on the bureau, let it be inside of you. Hear my voice, let it be inside of you." And we just kept expanding and expanding and expanding. And there was just a smile on her face. And she sat up and she kissed me. And then I said, "Well, you know what I know. Have a good death." And I left, and she died a few hours later with her husband. If I could just leave you with, I guess, one message. It is that you have the opportunity that many, many other people in your profession do not have. You have the opportunity to stay right at the edge of your spiritual truth in what you do and what you're getting paid to do for the most part. What an extraordinary gift you are being given. And the closer you get to living truth through the actual work that you do, the more you are there for the other person in the exact place they need you to be there, which is in the spirit behind all the forms. I was just with the dean of a cathedral, Episcopalian dean. And he said, "You know, when I finished my administration fundraising rituals," he said, "it's really hard to find time for my own spiritual practice." I said, "I can't believe it. Isn't all that your spiritual practice? I mean, how narrow can you define the game?" When I said to my guru, my spiritual teacher, "How will I know God, Maharaji?" He leaned forward and he said, "Feed people." So I thought maybe something got lost in the translation. So I said, "How could I get enlightened?" He said, "Serve people." And what I have learned is that there is a way of doing one's service that is one's spiritual practice. In Hinduism, it's called karma yoga. It's the path of coming to union with God through the way in which one acts in the world. To the extent that you work on yourself in your work with the dying, you become more a statement of what it is you are professing to believe. The radiance that emerges from you has the power then to rebalance the hospice organization. You're not going to do it by politics. Believe me. Because the medical community has that locked up. They know just how to do that. You're going to have to do it through the power of your own living spirit. I have a spook friend, Emmanuel. He speaks through a woman. He's a, you know, one of those. And so I said to Emmanuel, Emmanuel, I talk to people about dying. What should I tell people about death? Emmanuel gave me the best one-liner I have ever heard in my life. He said, Ram Dass, tell them that it's absolutely safe. Does that take the word safe and give a new meaning to it? It's not safe. It's safe. You're dying, it's safe. He said it's like taking off a tight shoe. Now, many of you heard the rabbi last night, Rabbi Kushner. He's of the religious tradition I grew up with. But what I heard was that I heard the speech of a humanist, basically. What he said was, it's really too bad we die. And what you can offer is to make the last moments of life as valuable as they can to make and make the person feel like somebody. And I would say that what your work is to do not that at all. But to find in yourself the perfect balance between life and death, where you're not grabbing at one or pushing away the other. You are merely listening and an instrument for the process. And that you're meeting this person behind all of our somebodynesses. When you can give up your clergy personness, then maybe the dying person can give up their dying personness. And we can just meet as fellow souls on an incredible journey. Thank you very much.
At this point, Death Is Not an Outrage continues with an informal question and answer session. To make it easier for you to follow along with this discussion, Sounds True will repeat the questions from the audience. The first question is, Mother Teresa is an Orthodox Christian. Is it possible to have the vision, experience, and ministry of which you speak and be an Orthodox Christian?
I think that if your first identity is as an Orthodox Christian, the answer is no. I think if your first identity is as a being of God or something beyond definition within a category system, then the answer is yes. If the investment in any role identity at all becomes a way in which you separate. And you can fulfill roles without being trapped by them. But within that role itself, it probably couldn't. Let me explain. that what I'm describing to you is I'm using a verbal technique to describe, to get as close as I can to a non-conceptual moment with another person. That it's the finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon, it's the finger. I agree that when the minute I talk, it immediately defines it. But that isn't, the talk is just the pointing at something that is in, that's the trouble of my business. I mean, of all of our businesses, I guess, we're always speaking about the unspeakable, and every time we speak about it, we lie. One has to keep working to live in, not in concept, even though one speaks in it.
Amen. Will you extend your remarks about bereavement?
It's a Japanese monk, and he's his child has died, and he's sitting, his student comes along and finds him sitting by the side of the road sobbing, and he says to him, "Master, why are you crying? You know it's all an illusion." And the master said, "Yes, I know that, and a child is the greatest of the illusions." I think that to the extent that we are identified with any thoughts of separateness. Let me see how to say this. That when something dies, whether it is another person or one's dream or one's expectation of the future or all of it, there is an experience of loss and a grief reaction. And that is the mind attempting to regain what it had or to deal in some way with it emotionally. And it seems to me that that my role with a person who is grieving is to support their grieving process, not encourage them to rush through it. Say, it's going to be like a roller coaster. You're going to go up and down, and just when you think it's over, it's going to hit you again. And you better expect probably 2 years of this before you come up for air. I mean, something like this. Realizing that, but I can do, it's like you can say something, it's the same thing we're talking about. You can say something within words that from where you're saying it makes it relatively real, but not absolutely real. In other words, you're saying, yes, within that sequence there is grieving. Within that reality there is grieving. When Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint, he was a great Indian saint, was dying, and his devotees started to cry, and they said, "Bhagwan, Ramana Maharshi, don't leave us, don't leave us." And he was just dying of cancer. He said, "Don't be silly, where could I go? I mean, I'm only dropping my body, what are you getting so upset about?" And what you begin to experience with grieving, what I say to people often is, if you touched another human being in true love, there's no way you can be separate from that person. Your mind will experience grief of loss because of the habits of the form through which you two were in love. But when your mind quiets down and you sit quietly a little bit after some time, you will feel the presence of that living love because it can't go anywhere. And I know that to be true so deeply in my being that I say it from that place. That's, yes.
Will you speak more about the encumbrances of Orthodox religion?
I feel that every practice, every method of getting to God is a trap. Every one of them. Meditation is a trap. The church is a trap. Doctrine is a trap. It is all a trap. But the thing is, for you to get there, you have to allow yourself to be trapped by the method. It doesn't work if you don't get trapped by it. And then you just hope it self-destructs at the other end. That's the only thing you can hope. Because you end up wanting to be free in God. You don't end up wanting to be a Christian. You want to end up wanting to be Christ, not being a Christian. I mean, it's the same thing. I'm sure this is heresy, and I'm taking terrible things. Realize I'm not a trained person, so you can't, you know, what can you do to me? Just realize I'm a flake that took too many drugs, and it's just irrelevant. Yes.
You may be a heretic, Ram Dass, but your mind is very wise, and you are aware that many of us who are sitting here today have experiences of what we know or think we might know about spirituality within the framework of the New Testament. My question is, knowing what you know about the New Testament, what is your response to the ideas about death that are expressed there?
I feel really absurd talking to this audience about Christianity, but here goes. Fools rush in. First of all, I love Jesus the Christ very deeply. And what I experience, the teaching of the death and the resurrection, was Jesus saying to us, I am like you. I will show you that what dies is not what is true. And I will come back and reassure you that that is the way it is. And if you understand that, then you will be freed from the suffering that is attendant to the fear of death. And I think it was the most magnificent essence of a teaching that exists in the Holy Literature.
How do you understand the dualistic nature of things?
I think for us to realize the fullness of what it means to be human, which means to have the human emotions and the human mind, and at the same moment have within us the divinity of the formless, and to realize that we are formless yet in form, and we are in form yet formless, and to live with that tension is one of the most exciting adventures, to do that with awareness. In my practice, which has involved very, very deep meditative practice, and I mean a very formal thing by meditation in the particular tradition that I work in, for example, I will go into a monastic room for 2 months and spend the 2 months just following my breath and watching my mind move out into anything, into thoughts of God, into thoughts about what I'm going to eat next, about all of it. I come out for 2 meals a day, that's it. I see the teacher for 5 minutes a day, 2 months, 7 days a week, from 3 a.m. till 11 at night every day, just sitting, following the breath. Just each breath in and out, right at the abdomen, the little muscle. What it is a primary object of concentration. And the result is, at first you see your mind grab and take you here and take you there and take you there and take you there, and you keep bringing it back like a flower. You bring it back and you bring it back. And after a while, it just sits in that one place. And when the mind starts to sit in that one place, it becomes concentrated. It becomes like a laser beam for penetrating into the nature of things. And what you're doing is penetrating into the nature of the way in which your own thoughts are creating your reality. And you're standing in the awareness behind thought, watching thought manifest and watching the universe come into play and exist. And as a result of that technique and that practice, which I continually do, I'm doing it with my beads, I'm doing it all the time, I'm constantly staying in that tension between the emptiness and the form. Nothing's happening and I'm talking. I'm talking and I'm not talking. There is something going on and there is something not going on. There is matter, there is spirit, and there is form. And they are just like the two sides of one thing. And I just live constantly with that tension.
I think there are many ways of working with energy when you are sitting with a dying person. For example, the laying on of hands. What do you think about this?
Gandhi at one point was on a train, and a reporter rushed up and said, "Give me a message to take back to my people." And Gandhi scribbled on a paper bag and handed it out, and it said, "My life is my message." And my sense is that everything that you have, that all of your spiritual work on yourself has brought you to, is manifested in everything you are. And that ultimately, the way you shake a hand, the way you look, the way you pass somebody on the street, it's all a statement of your being. It's not just when you think you're being holy. It's all it. You know, this is it. It's it in the bathroom, and it's it on the street, and it's it at the supermarket. It's all of it. And you're just making a statement of who you are. And I feel that as you are more and more just living spirit, or that you're connected to that plane of consciousness and reality that doesn't have form, that doesn't have boundaries to it, that the energy that comes out of you embraces everything, embraces, and people feel embraced by it. They feel loved by it, and it comes in any different number of ways through. It can be through touch, through look, through sound, it can be anyway.
I experience in our world what I would call a chauvinism of humanity, and I've heard you talk about internal reality and illusion, and briefly about your mushroom experience, but I wonder if you could talk about the non-human part of our world and how we relate to that.
I think that as one extricates oneself from one's own thought and goes into that space that exists out of which thought arises, one experiences oneness with all form, whether it is animate or what we call inanimate. I also experience all of form as consciousness, not self-consciousness, but consciousness. So that there is a way, and of having been with my guru in India, I saw this phenomenon. There is a way in which I saw his awareness be coming from inside something rather than knowing it from outside in. In other words, whether or not you know things subjectively or objectively depends on where you're standing in your own head. The thinking mind, the intellect, can know things only objectively, so that inanimate objects are all them or that. As you extricate your own awareness from defined boundaries of thought, the awareness, which includes all of it, becomes your reference place from which you're standing. There's no you, but you're part of it. It's all just standing in itself. So the compassion, which I think is very different as a word from caring, by the way. Caring is a thing you do for somebody else. Compassion is with. And I think really compassion is joining with in the unity that exists in by opening to the suffering of all things. And as one experiences what happens to the earth, for example, at this moment in its evolutionary cycle in terms of ecological realities, there is a kind of a pain that people feel that they don't conceptually know how to deal with. That is the pain of things not being in harmony or not being listened to that are part of the greater body. So I would say there is a wisdom in us that knows the rest of the universe as ourself, but we don't know how to act from that place of knowledge. Because it's not knowledge, it's wisdom. Yeah.
My difficulty in working with hospice is assisting individual members of the 5 billion people on this planet to their death, but knowing that elsewhere, many of these 5 billion people are killing each other and the planet itself. And it's difficult for me sometimes to affirm as important what I'm doing because it seems humanly chauvinistic compared to what is going on at the planet at this point in time.
As you get emptier and emptier, what you hear is what could be called your vocation, or in India it would be called your dharma. That is, you hear the part you play in the sea of suffering. and you see that you enter into it when you enter into it, and that it's neither better nor worse than where someone else enters into it. And you stop judging, am I dealing with the worst suffering? Because that one will drive you absolutely up the wall. Because I work with people that are blind in Nepal. We do cataract surgery. I mean, in 4 minutes, somebody who has been blind in a country where they go, where their paths in the mountains like this, has sight back in 4 minutes, and it costs $20. Isn't that amazing? And this, there used to be, when we started, there were 200,000 people waiting for that operation. Now it's all different. But so you say, well, my God, here you can do something in 4 minutes that'll give somebody their sight back. Isn't that incredible? Then I go to Guatemala, and I come to these villages where the women watched all their husbands be murdered. And they're trying to build their lives back, and they've got nothing, but nothing. And their children are all dying of vitamin deficiency. You say, oh my God, I got to do something there. And then you come back and you meet an AIDS person who's frightened and whose life is crumbling. And you hold them in your arms and you say, oh, I've got to do this. And then if you start rationally to figure that out, you can't do it. There's no way you can do that. And you have to understand, first of all, that inherent in incarnation is suffering. And that the root cause of suffering has to do with the mind. One person's dying, they're suffering. Another person's dying, they're not suffering. Isn't that interesting? It has to do with where their mind is in relation to their dying, in relation to their pain, in relation to all of it. Your job is to relieve suffering in the world. You will feel at harmony in the universe if you are relieving suffering in the world. The suffering you have to relieve, partly because you are an instrument, is your own suffering. And it's an interesting thing for hospice to deal with the fact that from a psychological place, death stinks. And from a spiritual place, it is just a great transformative experience. And unless hospice has that exact balance, it has lost its game. It's lost its mandate, as far as I'm concerned. And it's in your hands. Thank you.
This concludes Death is Not an Outrage with Ram Dass. For additional copies of this recording or a complete catalog of transformational audio tapes, please call Sounds True 303-449-6229 or write 735 Walnut Street, Boulder, Colorado 80302.